Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 1st, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Jim Farrell. Today's session number is 1 and is titled The Moral Ecology of Everyday Life. Let's listen in.
And then I'm going to pause for 2 seconds and say, my name is Jim Farrell. The title of this session is The Moral Ecology of Everyday Life. The subtitle has something to do with McDonald's hamburgers. And several people have asked me today if the main thing I'm going to talk about is McDonald's hamburgers and if they would ever be allowed to eat one after I was done talking about them. And I need to warn you that the main thing of this talk is not McDonald's hamburgers. It's really a kind of a way of thinking about things, and McDonald's hamburgers are simply one example of that. A lot of the other things that I'm going to be doing in the next couple of weeks are more examples of how to look at the moral ecology of everyday life by looking very carefully at particular things, what I would call dense facts. We do have seats in here. There's some back here. Here, if you want to raise hands where there are various seats, we'll get people in here and get a seat. I've been to 2 sessions today. I went to Bruce's session and I went to Sherry's session, and both of them managed to think without paper, which just amazes me that they have that kind of memory and wisdom about them. I'm a historian. I'm probably the only historian in the world that has no memory at all. So I'm going to work from a text here that I have, and I need to let you know at the beginning of it that when somebody works with a text, you think that they know what they're doing and that there's a structure to it and all that sort of thing. That's not the case. This is a text where there's no train of thought going on here. You can't derail me with a question. You can ask any question you want. My students do this all the time. They think they have me off on a tangent. My feeling is there are no tangents in American studies, which is what I do. If people have questions, that's what we ought to be talking about. And so I do have a text here, and I will talk it through if it seems like it's working for you. But if it's not, get me off on a tangent, and we'll do something more interesting than this.
Is there more of your handouts here?
Apparently there are no more handouts. So you'll have to share with somebody else for taking the exam. And actually, there's an exam in this talk. I'm a college teacher, which means that I get paid to have conversations with students, conversations with other academics, conversations with the people living and dead whose books I read. Today, I'd like to invite you into my conversational circle by telling you about some things I've learned in my conversations so far, and by inviting you to tell me some things that I can tell others after this. A good example of that would be the magazine In Context, which came to me in a Holden discussion here. I now subscribe to it. It's a wonderful journal for thinking about the kinds of issues that we're going to be talking about tonight. A lot of what you'll hear today comes from my listening or my conversations with Robert Bella, David Orr, Alan Derning, Barbara Kingsolver, and Wendell Berry. And I brought 3 of their books along, and I'm going to use them a little bit, but then I'll pass them around. The 2 books that you can find in the bookstore that I've ordered for this week are How Much is Enough by Alan Derning. David Orr, I think, says that this is the most important question of the late 20th century, how much is enough? And Derning does a wonderful job describing, as the subtitle says, The Consumer Society and the Future of the Earth. Really wonderful book, very, very readable. The other one that I have here is The Age of Missing Information by Bill McKibben, who's a masochist. He taped all 105 channels of the largest cable system in the country for a 24-hour period and watched all of it to see what information you can get from TV in a 24-hour span. And then he took a walk up a mountain for 24 hours. And what he does in this book is compare the quality of information that you get from watching TV with the quality of information that you get from being in nature, being in situations like we are here at Holden. And he does a brilliant job of this. Anyway, these people have helped me think about what Robert Bella calls the moral ecology of everyday life, a phrase I like to use a lot, and I hope to help you think about it too. Every year in May, I participate in a ritual called college graduation. I put on my gown and march in as much pomp and circumstance as I can muster in a peculiar rite of passage for about 700 young people. We call it commencement because it marks the beginning of their lives as competent, compassionate adults in service to their communities. As I sit and watch them cross the stage to get their degrees, I am always filled with questions. Questions about education and about the society that shapes education for these students and for us. St. Olaf students know a lot that they didn't know 4 years earlier. But is it enough? They have all passed a history course, a literature class, a philosophy credit. They have finished the religion requirement, and they've encountered science and mathematics. They know something about the arts and speech. They have been introduced to two social sciences and a couple of physical activities. They have specialized in a major. They know a lot, but do they know enough? A lot of this depends on the answer to a question that Wendell Berry poses as the title of one of his books of essays. What are people for? What are people for? What do you think? The book of Genesis gives us one answer to that question. God creates the earth. She bestows it as a gift. She looks at it, and she sees that it is very good. This is, as Dan McGuire once said, the most radical statement in the Bible. The creation is good, and if we screw it up, it's not God's fault. It's ours. Another radical statement appears in the same story. Among the animals of creation are Adam and Eve. God creates Adam and Eve in her own image, and then she tells them, among other things, be fruitful and multiply, replenish the earth and have dominion over it. The radical statement is not the part about being fruitful and multiplying. Most animals will do that without much instruction at all. The radical part is what follows, replenish the earth. This sometimes gets missed in all the language of subduing the earth and having dominion over it. But in fact, it tells us what the dominion must be like. People must have a relationship with the earth that fills it up again, which is exactly what replenish means, that fills it up again, that makes it whole, that makes it healthy, that makes it holy. The whole complex of words that Wendell Berry points out are etymologically related to one another, that keeps it, as God said, very good. This simple sentence is an invitation to Adam and Eve and to you and me to take part in the ongoing gift of God's creation, to be co-creators with God. Creation wasn't done on the sixth day, and God rested on the seventh day, not because the work was done, but because it wasn't. The Sabbath was not so much for God, who probably wasn't particularly tired, but for God's co-creators, who needed time to think about how to respond to the gift of creation by replenishing the earth. Now, have we taught our students this? To some extent, yes, I think we have. Environmental studies programs are growing quickly at colleges, and the younger generation is much more ecologically conscious than we were at their age. They know about the dangers of global warming and ozone thinning and toxic waste and deforestation and endangered species. They know, as Andrew Shapiro points out in a brilliant little book called We're Number One, that the United States is, I'm going to give you a list of things now, first in the world in greenhouse gas emissions and first in contributing to acid rain, first in air pollutants per capita, first in use of freshwater resources, first in forest depletion, first in paper consumption per capita, first in garbage per capita, first in hazardous waste per capita, first in nuclear reactors and nuclear testing, first in gasoline consumption per capita, first in oil imports, and first in oil spills affecting our shores. First in TVs per capita. This has to do with Bill McKibben's book, The Age of Missing Information. First in cars per capita, and first in use of cars instead of public transportation. And I'll talk a little bit more about cars on Saturday, I think. As a historian, I should remind you that 103 years ago, 100% of Americans managed to live their lives without cars. But in the last 103 years, we have created a car culture in which fossil fuel-burning, carbon dioxide-emitting automobiles are a virtual necessity. But the greenhouse effect has little or no effect on the way that we live our lives, in large part, I think, because we have only educated above the neck, and then only in abstractions, and in part because mere knowledge is never enough. David Orr's book, Ecological Literacy, a wonderful book of essays on really what it does mean to be ecologically literate. He takes, for example, the E.G. Hirsch's stuff on cultural literacy and says, that's fine, that's great, but it doesn't tell you much about your relationship to the world, to the natural world. And if you want to be ecologically literate, he says, here's another list of things that you need to know, another set of ideas. But Orr suggests that, for example, that the medium of ecological literacy has contradicted the message. We teach students about ecological literacy in institutions which, for the most part, operate according to the ecological illiteracy of American culture, promoting short-term efficiency and convenience over long-term environmental benefits. At St. Olaf, most of our students have not the slightest idea about the sources of the resources that they use every day. When St. Olaf undertook a study of our resource flows in a project called The College and the Biosphere, we discovered, for example, that the average molecule of food on campus traveled 1,500 miles before it made it to our mouths. Some of our apple juice came from West Germany, even though there are organic apple orchards in our county. Such patterns of resource use are standard operating procedure in American culture. They are part of what Robert Bella calls the problem of invisible complexity. I'll put that phrase on the board there because it's one that I come back to over and over again and will in the next 2 weeks. It's really what I try to do as a college teacher, is to explain the problem of invisible complexity. We do one thing, there's a visible side of it, and then there's this whole invisible infrastructure of it, of values and institutions and ideas that for the most part we miss. But we live with this problem of invisible complexity, in which the consequences of our actions are hidden from us by ideas and institutions that keep us focused on our lives as individuals rather than on our lives as members of communities, both social and ecological. And ignorance of these patterns makes us good citizens of what Barbara Kingsolver calls the nation in love with forgetting. This is a phrase I like a lot, and so again, I put that on the board there. The nation in love with forgetting. In her beautiful and provocative novel called Animal Dreams, Kingsolver shows a high school biology teacher who does something different. Cody Nolene says of her class, "What did I expect? They were teenagers. I knew that. But still, I screamed at them because the Black Mountain Mine was poisoning their mother's milk and all they cared about was sex and a passing grade. I had rational intentions. I talked about evapotranspiration and rainforests and oxygen in the biosphere, how everything was connected. The last virgin timber cleared and milled to make way for a continent of landfills choking on old newspapers. It was a poetic lecture. Marta made the mistake of asking me how much of this poetry was going to be on the test. I glowered. Your life is the test. If you flunk this one, you die." Cody began to put the abstractions into personal terms, telling the class, for example, about stonewashed jeans. "You know how they make those? They wash them in a big machine with a special kind of gravel they get out of volcanic mountains. The prettiest mountains you ever saw in your life, but they're fragile, like a big pile of sugar. Levi Strauss or whoever goes in there with bulldozers and chainsaws and cuts down the trees and rips the mountainside to hell, so that all of us lucky Americans can wear jeans that look like somebody threw them in the garbage before we got them." And she continued, "Think about the gas you put in a car, the real cost." There's a wonderful book by Richard North called that, The Real Cost. "Not just pumping it out of the ground and refining it and shipping it, but also cleaning up the oil spills and all the junk that goes into the air when it gets burned. That's part of what it costs, but you're not paying it. Gas ought to be $20 a gallon, so you're getting a real good deal. But soon the bill comes due, and we pay it or we eat dirt. The ultimate master charge." We do something similar in my American Ecological History class. It's an environmental impact statement of American history, a course that traces the ecological revolutions of the last five centuries. Because that history is alive and well today in the ideas, institutions, and individuals of American culture, because we are all embodiments of American ecological history, we conclude the course by writing environmental impact statements on ourselves. To counter the consumer forgetfulness and the problem of invisible complexity that are part of our historical heritage, we examine the ways that we are complicit with ideas and institutions in American history that have either raped or replenished the earth. A couple of years ago, one of the environmental impact statements began, "I believe that, given today's society, it is impossible for an American to have a positive impact on our environment." What he means is that the ideological and institutional infrastructure of this country virtually guarantees that a normal, good American will live a life that is neither just nor sustainable. It is not just because it is not possible for all people on earth to live this way. And it is not sustainable because we are depleting resources at a rate that cannot last. Since 1940, notes Alan Derning in this How Much Is Enough, Americans alone have used up as large a share of the Earth's mineral resources as did everybody before them combined. We are stealing the gift of creation from our children and grandchildren because we are not replenishing the Earth. And we are not replenishing the Earth in part because we are not replenishing the social institutions and community resources that could give us the satisfactions that we now seek in consumption. We have created what David Orr calls social traps, another concept that I think is real important, situations in which people are drawn into individually rational behavior that is destructive to the planet. The suburbs where I live are such a social trap. Because I live in the suburbs and because I worship in Minneapolis, I quite rationally drive to church each Sunday without thinking about the ways in which my rational choice has been channeled by government policy concerning highways and social beliefs and behavior about the importance of individual choice in American culture, that I should be able to choose any church that I want to and go however far I want to go to get there. I drive without thinking, and sometimes I work without thinking, and I often eat without thinking, and I'm often entertained without thinking. In many ways, my life is unthinkable. In the next few days, however, I'd like to invite all of us to prepare an environmental impact statement on ourselves. I'd like to think about everyday life to see if we can begin to see the problem of invisible complexity, the social traps, the structures that structure the habits of our hearts and lives. I'd like to figure out why good people like me do evil to other people and to the planet. To do this, I'll try to see myself and people like me as part of resource flows of food, water, energy, materials, and waste. I want to notice how Americans notice nature and where they notice it. On the average, Americans spend 2% of their time outside. I would like to take an inventory of all the electrical appliances in my house and calculate the environmental costs of their use. If you ever do this, it's an amazing list that you come up with of electrical appliances. I'd like to figure out the ecosystem that is my lawn. I need to think about what I waste and where it goes. I need to think about my two children, who, if they are average Americans, will consume 80 times more resources than a child in India. We often think that the third world has population problems, but when you sort of think about it in those terms, in terms of consumption, we have population problems if we have as many as two children. I will look for the problem of invisible complexity, the consumer forgetfulness, the social traps, to see if my life is sustainable. I want to understand why I act the way I do, why, in short, I act like an American. In doing this, I want to use the concept... Oh, thank you very much. The concept... of a moral ecology as a framework. According to Habits of the Heart, which is a wonderful book, moral ecology is the web of moral understandings and commitments that tie people together in community. Robert Penn Warren beautifully expresses the idea of a web of moral ecology in the central image of his novel, All the King's Men. And here's a paragraph from that. Cass Mastern is one of the characters. Cass Mastern lived for a few years, and in that time he learned that the world is like an enormous spider web. And if you touch it, however lightly, at any point, the vibration ripples to the remotest perimeter and the drowsy spider feels the tingle and is drowsy no more but springs out to fling the gossamer coils about you who have touched the web and inject the black numbing poison under your hide. It does not matter whether or not you meant to touch the web of things. Your happy foot or gay wing may have brushed it ever so lightly, but what happens always happens. And there is the spider, bearded black, and with his great faceted eyes glittering in the sun like God's eye, and the fangs dripping. I love this image of the web. And the word web derives from a root meaning to weave, as do the words complexity and complicity. They come from the Latin complectere and suggest that we are complicit in the complexities of our culture, including what Bella and his collaborators call the problem of invisible complexity. This problem of invisible complexity consists of these institutional structures that frame our beliefs and behavior. They are the cultural lenses that tell us what we see and what we don't see when we're doing something. Often on driving vacations, we stop at McDonald's to get fast food so that we can get where we're going. Usually, if we don't end up in the Barb Farrell line, my wife has a penchant for getting in the very longest line in any situation, whatever. That's called the Barb Farrell line. We can be in and out of a McDonald's in about 15 minutes. There's a lot to see in the average McDonald's, but there's a lot more to it than meets the eye. If we look behind the scenes of the dining room, what would we see? Or often I ask my students this question when we talk about food. If we are what we eat, what are we? Well, if we get a hamburger at McDonald's, we're meat. And that meat is protein. In the United States, we eat twice the daily protein requirement daily. If we eat a hamburger, we're eating resources. We're eating resources that come from the patterns of agriculture that we've established. We're eating dirt because the patterns of agriculture that we've established are largely monoculture, so there's lots of erosion from it and soil depletion. We're eating forests to some extent because the forests are cut down for cattle grazing. We're eating 16 pounds of feed, vegetable protein, for a pound of beef, especially on feedlots where the cattle are fed various grains. We're eating water, and we're, in fact, eating with that one hamburger more water than we use all day from the tap, because it takes 2,500 gallons of water to produce a pound of beef. And we're eating oil because we're eating the oil that's needed to power the tractors to produce the feed that we feed to the cattle. This is sort of like the house that Jack built, the way that you go along. We're also eating homogenous, unadventurous food when we eat at McDonald's. This is the best that I can say for it. But it has to do with what I would call the McDonald's phenomenon. The McDonald's phenomenon is that you are getting something that's absolutely predictable. Every time you stop at a McDonald's, you know you will get an absolutely mediocre hamburger. You will never get a great hamburger at a McDonald's, no matter what they advertise about the Arch Deluxe. I've tried it. It's not a great hamburger. It's a thoroughly mediocre hamburger, and you get it every time. On the other hand, you never get a really, really horrible hamburger at a McDonald's, one that tastes like horse meat. Every once in a while, you can get one of those at some other kinds of places. So this predictability is real important for Americans, and particularly for younger Americans, as I've discovered in my travels.
You used to be able to get a cup of coffee there that was 10 degrees too hot, though.
40 degrees too hot, and Bruce will talk about that on what day?
Next week.
If you want to know more about the cup of coffee, that cup of coffee, if you want to know about general cups of coffee, that would be me on Thursday or on Friday. If you want to know about the legalities of coffee, then you want to talk about Bruce next week. Another thing that we consume when we go to McDonald's is simply convenience or ease. That's what we have fast food for and franchising, and this is the very idea of McDonald's. Another thing that we consume when we eat at McDonald's is attitudes about food and family and fellowship that are represented in the ads that we see for McDonald's. We see parents and children uniquely bonding in the booths and playlands under the golden arches. We are told that we deserve a break today. This has something to do with our attitudes towards work and the kind of alienation that comes from the works that we often do. If we eat at McDonald's, we are part of a car culture, since most McDonald's depend on the car for their business. If we eat at McDonald's, we are eating packaging, because McDonald's packages everything that they serve to you, even though they've changed from the chlorofluorocarbons in their stuff to other kinds of packaging. If we are eating at McDonald's, we're in a way also eating people. Because we're eating underpaid fast food help. One of the laws in the United States is known as the McDonald's law, because McDonald's fought very hard to keep the minimum wage low and to make it so that for part-time employees, you don't have to pay benefits for them. We are in some ways eating people who are mechanized when they work at McDonald's. The routines of McDonald's are absolutely set out for them in the manual and at McDonald's University, where they go to learn how to be fast food help. We're eating changes in meals and family meals and school meals as a result of our increasing familiarity with Ronald McDonald. We're eating a pattern of corporate philanthropy, including the Ronald McDonald houses, which are one of the good sides of McDonald's. We're involved in a kind of eating that involves a corporate structure in the United States. Corporations are socialist constructions that give business people limited liability so that they can amass enough capital to pursue their business. They were invented in the 19th century for exactly that reason, and all corporations at that time were designated for public purposes. You had to have a public purpose in mind to be a corporation. That changed in the course of the 19th century, but they were chartered by the states because they are supposed to be performing a public good. In the last century, they've increasingly come to be understood as a part of private enterprise, which I think is a real loss in American culture. Corporations ought to be responsible for the public good. Corporation laws are among the laws that governments like mine enact to promote and regulate the sale of commodities. When I eat at McDonald's, I'm eating at a place that assumes that corporations exist to make profits and not for any other purpose. McDonald's is also a fine symbol of a market economy, which says essentially that it will meet the needs and the wants of people with money. If I want a hamburger, I better find some money, because they won't just give me one if I walk up there, especially not with my good looks. If any of you happen to see my picture on the kiosk there, my sons refer to me as the dork. So anyway, just with that one hamburger, we're pretty far into something that's pretty complex. A lot of invisible complexity there behind that hamburger. If we added a Coke and fries to it, which we won't do tonight, we would find even more complexities in this complicity, and vice versa. Now, Holden, in contrast, is designed to make the complexity visible, which is one of the really wonderful things about Holden. In the orientation meeting the other day, Deanne used this wonderful phrase, said that the purpose of Holden is to make the infrastructure transparent, so that, you know, all this chopping up of things that we do to put in the compost and know where everything came from, to know what's in the food that we're eating, is to make visible the complexity that's part of people's lives. So anyways, you can see the ideas and institutions that structure a hamburger are inherently ecological because they are a web of relationships. They are moral because they are concerned with questions of the good life. There are lots of ways, about 10 ways in there, which are involved with questions of the good life. Is it good for families to eat in or out? Is it good for us to drive cars or not? Is it good for us to practice certain patterns of agriculture or not? Those are all moral questions that are involved with eating at McDonald's. The ideas and institutions of everyday life enact our relationships with one another more frequently and more persistently than we can meeting face to face. Yet most Americans don't understand much at all about the ideas and the institutions that they are part of and reproducing by their actions in them all the time. Habits, they become habits for us. And Robert Merritt says habits are a means by which culture is internalized and given continuity at the level of the individual self. The culture teaches us how to act, and then we act in fairly predictable ways most of the time. They are individualized versions of institutionalization. They demand respectful attention. But these ideas and institutions are not the only possible ones, and I'd also like to consider some alternatives. What virtues in our common lives would produce actions that were harmonious in a larger commonwealth? And I want to emphasize the word virtues there. I'm going to talk about it again on Thursday because it was one that the founding fathers used a lot at the time of the Declaration of Independence. And if they hadn't used that phrase a lot, they couldn't have written the Declaration the way that they did. What virtues in our lives would produce actions that were harmonious in larger commonwealth? And what sort of commonwealths must we create in order to encourage the harmonious action that we expect from individuals? Perhaps we could learn from the Amish and other so-called backward peoples who have shaped a culture that preserves the virtues of humility, simplicity, moderation, prudence, frugality, hard work, neighborliness, and family stability. Perhaps we could relearn a religion of relatedness. The root of the word religion is religare, which means to bind together. And so religion ought to bind us to each other and to the creation. I have here a list of some questions that we can consider in the next 2 weeks, but I've already given you a handout with lots of questions, so I think I'll skip that part. And I also have a poem that I could read you if nobody has any questions. It's a Wendell Berry poem that I'll read again on Thursday morning because it fits with the revolution, called The Mad Farmer Manifesto. But I think I've heard my voice for long enough, and probably you have too, so I think I'll stop here and see what's on your minds. Nothing. This is what's on my student's mind.
Explain for us, if you would, consumer forgetfulness. It seems to me if the complexity is invisible, that seems to suggest we never find out what it is. Forgetfulness seems to suggest something different.
Yeah, consumer forgetfulness is a term that William Cronin uses. He wrote a brilliant book called Nature's Metropolis, which is on Chicago and Chicago's role in the development of the whole North American ecology in the 19th century, because it becomes really the market center for everything. And what he says is that by the end of the 19th century, when you get a Ward's catalog, what you've got is sort of built-in consumer forgetfulness. Now, that would be what Bella would call the problem of invisible for complexity. Now, I would say that those two at that point are really identical, and probably the problem of invisible complexity is a better one. However, what also happens in American culture, and I'll use a different term than forgetfulness, is ignorance. It seems to me that there are two kinds of ignorance in American culture. One of them is the ignorance that you're talking about. God, I didn't know all that stuff about a hamburger. Or I didn't know all that stuff about a cup of coffee. Nobody ever told me that. We didn't teach that in schools. I think there are reasons. I mean, I think we don't teach that stuff in schools because it would make us uncomfortable. So we avoid that stuff in schools. And I'll talk about that some next week. So that's one kind of ignorance. I didn't know. The other kind of ignorance is I learned it, but I'm going to ignore it. And that's an active kind of ignorance. And I think that most of us do it a lot. We know lots of things that are wrong with the world. And we simply have to live our lives in one way or another, think we have to live our lives in one way or another. And so we decide, I'm going to ignore those. And, I'm going to go out for a Sunday drive anyway, even though I know I'm emitting 5 pounds of carbon for every gallon of gas that I'm using. There are those two kinds of ignorance, I think.
What do you do about it in your everyday life to make you feel that you're living it, a life as you would, as you feel that it's important to live it?
I don't think I ever live a life as I ought to live it. But the question was. When you hear all of these invisible complexities, and if someone knew more of them than the ones I've just described now, and I do, is that overwhelming, A, and is it possible then to live a life that conforms more to the way that you think you ought to live? This is never overwhelming to me, partly because I'm a Pollyanna. Just the way it is. Partly because I'm a historian. And one of the things that happens when you're a historian is you look at these things and say, all of these things are socially constructed. There were no McDonald's before 1955. And people decided for one reason or another they were going to make McDonald's in that particular way. That means that people can decide to do any other thing they want to do. One of the main concepts in history is one that I call contingency, which means that at any given moment, anything can happen. At this very moment, I might leap up on this fireplace here and dance. And that's a possibility. It's not a very large possibility. Because I don't dance and I'm very shy. I don't think it will happen here today. But it's a possibility. Contingency says at any given time anything can happen. And what a historian usually tries to do is why, in a certain circumstance, some things happened and other things didn't. Well, we're in a circumstance where some things can happen and other things won't. And it's up to us to make those decisions. The other thing about looking at the problem of invisible complexity the way that I do, which is to say to bring it down to individual dense facts like eating a hamburger, is that any time you don't eat a hamburger, you've made a change. You've changed the world. Now, students often say to me, well, I can't change the world, so I'm just not going to do anything about it. But in fact, you do change the world every time you make a decision. And you change the world by simply acting in the standard operating procedure as well. Because when you act in the standard operating procedure, when you show up at McDonald's and buy your Happy Meal, an odd description for something that I've just described in the way that I did. We should maybe describe it as an unhappy meal. When you get there and buy your unhappy meal, you are reproducing the institutions that will allow the continuance of McDonald's. So you think that you don't have any impact on history at all, but you are every day, all the time, making decisions that are of tremendous historical import. And in fact, the decisions that people make as consumers in American society are much more important than any of the decisions, most of the decisions, I would say, that Bill Clinton will make in the next 4 years.
I'm trying to get a feel for what you're talking about, the individual response under the individual capacity. But can you really address that without talking about such things within that terminology of political financing by corporate?
No.
And what I'm thinking about is Nader's position lately that you can't tell the difference between the Republicans and Democrats, basically, as to who is putting the money into the coffers. They're both corporate supporting political parties. And that's
right. I would say that, and this relates to the, I've just finished writing a book on the 60s called The Spirit of the 60s, and the thing that I've looked at in the 60s is what I call political personalism, which is a phrase that people didn't use very much at that time, but it dates back to the Catholic worker movement in the 1930s, and they used it a lot. Martin Luther King actually went to Boston University to study because that was where the center of American personalism was. And what personalism said basically is that individuals are socially constituted and they have responsibility to communities, and therefore they have to act as individuals in their communities. So the Catholic worker says basically there are poor people. God, let's feed them. We can do that. And they just did. They went out and fed them. On the other hand, they said that people are in communities and those communities are structured in certain ways, and we also need to change the structures. So they're always working on two levels. One of them is a personal and individual level. I'm not going to eat any more McDonald's hamburgers. The other is to say I want to change laws in some way that might make it more conducive for the kind of enterprises that I want. Or David Orr talks about what all that he says that he really wants in the world is what he calls honest accounting. He wants to know the real cost of things. So if McDonald's was required to simply put on the package for the hamburger, what are the social costs of this hamburger? You know, if it came in that little waxy wrapping, and each waxy wrapping had a lecture of about the length that I gave you on the social consequences of a hamburger, that could make a difference. But in fact, what we've done in American society is create a system where we know, as Orr would say, we know the price of everything and the cost of nothing, because we never are able to figure out all of the things that are behind what we do. And so we need to ask the government to create regulations for us that do that. Or in our workplaces, we need to say, I want to make some of this complexity visible. Or the other thing that was important about personalism for me is that they simply said that human persons are inviolable. They are what everything is about. So to answer Wendell Berry's question, what are people for? You might say people are for the glory of God and the benefit of each other. And anything that doesn't contribute to that is a sin. That'd make it really hard. I mean, this society doesn't operate in that way. But we've become so accustomed to institutions that depersonalize people. And the personalists were simply saying it doesn't have to be that way. We can think of alternatives to these institutions.
You're saying or implying that ethically or some other way, morally perhaps, if you opt or I opt not to eat at McDonald's, but don't make it my life's mission to go out and convince 1,000 people to do likewise, and each of them 1,000 people, and to eventually bring McDonald's down, if McDonald's continues to exist just by you're not getting that hamburger X number of times per month, you're doing the right thing.
No, I wouldn't even say that. I would say that people need to make their own judgments about how these things balance out, because there are good things about McDonald's. One of them is you can get in and out in 15 minutes if you're not in the barbed trail line. That's an advantage. And the McDonald's is there because it serves needs that we have in American culture. And one of the, when, for example, and it's related to lots of other things too. For example, McDonald's is more and more popular now. People are eating more and more meals outside the home, something like 52% of meals now, I think. Outside the home, because the pressures of work are getting so strenuous on us. And again, I'm going to talk about that again next week too, what Juliet Shore calls the overworked American. Structures of work are really taking away our time, and therefore we're trying to save time in other places, and McDonald's is a good place to save time.
Well, no, it's not. But it looks like a good place to save time, and they keep telling us it's a good place to save time, and so lots of us do. And there are other pressures that are involved in getting us to do that. So I don't... somebody asked me if earlier today if they came to this session, if they'd ever be able to eat a hamburger again. I will. I'll be able to eat a hamburger again. I'll probably be able to eat one at McDonald's again, too. It doesn't seem to me that it's so absolutely immoral that I should stop doing it. But I ought to be conscious of the impact of things there and try to achieve some kind of balance in my life that honors those sorts of things. And the personalists were, for example, they thought the power of example was the power of everything. I mean, they didn't believe a whole lot in giving speeches. They believed in simply showing up. Putting your body on the line was something that was used a lot in the civil rights movement and in the 60s. And that was what they wanted people to do. Simply by your own example, you teach some people things. And you also have a worldwide impact when you do that, even though you don't know it. And it can happen through your children. It can happen through friends, neighbors. For me, the best example of that was in the early 80s. I had a student at St. Olaf. I was in a tutorial with her in the paracollege, and she got date raped in the middle of that semester. And so she came into tutorial one day, and her face was just vacant. I mean, her body had showed up, but her mind was simply not there. And I said, you know, you really look disturbed. Do you want to talk about it? And she did. She started crying and kind of broke down in the office. The rest of that semester, we just kind of took walks together for a tutorial. And in paracollege, you can do this. It's a wonderful educational thing where you do individual tutorials and you start out doing one thing, and if something else occurs in the middle of it, you switch and do that other thing. And they're not graded and they're done by narrative evaluation, you simply do a narrative evaluation saying, we were doing this, and then we shifted and we did that, and then we went back to doing this. And I'll tell you another example of that in a minute. We were doing a tutorial in literature, and so we did some reading that was related to some of the things that she was feeling, and we talked about some of that. But some of the time we just walked, I was just present to her, but didn't do anything in particular. And I didn't think anything very much of it, you know. She was a student that I liked, and so walking with her seemed about the least that I could do, and it didn't seem like very much. She left St. Olaf. She went to Nicaragua and worked in the Nicaraguan Revolution for a while, married a Nicaraguan, came back, discovered or found that she was lesbian, worked in a lesbian bookstore, now out in the Northwest here somewhere doing earth sheltered housing. And she writes me from time to time saying, I couldn't have done any of this without the support that you gave me at that time. And I hadn't intended to do that particularly or to change her life in any dramatic sort of way, but it just happened by virtue of that. And I think we probably all do that in some ways a lot of the time. And so simply it's a matter of being present and attentive most of the time in our lives if we can.
You made reference to a couple of books you suggested over at the
store.
Can you just say a little bit more about what they're about?
Well, How Much is Enough is the Consumer Society and the Future of the Earth, and he describes the consumption patterns of first world, second world, and third world peoples, but focuses really on the United States, and talks about the environmental costs of consumption, what it means to live in a consumer society, why, in fact, we're not satisfied by it. If you ask people, how happy are you? They asked in 1957, they asked again fairly recently. The percentage is exactly the same, although incomes have doubled in that time. So you would think if money bought happiness, we'd be happier than we are. But in fact, we're not, and I would guess right now, in general, happiness is kind of going down. So, and then he talks a little bit at the end about why this happens, what are the structures that create this consumer society, and I'll be talking about this for a lot of the week. And particularly when we talk about shopping and what makes us shop the way that we do. And then at the end he talks about some alternatives and some things that he thinks we need to think about. He says basically it's not sustainable to live at a first... The world can't stand any more Americas, and it's moving in that direction. So, for example, China had 10 years ago only 2% of Chinese had color TVs, now 35% of them do. So, and the world is imitating these consumption patterns that we have here, and they're not sustainable. He said everybody could live at second world levels. And second world levels could be a lot better than they are in the second world, because the first world has technologies that could make the sort of the life of the second world a lot more hospitable.
than it is. But we would need to make sort of collective decisions that that's what we want to do. And the example, because we've been a bad example for so long, that we would now need to be a better example of what's possible. The age of missing information goes back and forth between his watching of TV and some descriptions of that and what he learns on the mountain. And he's a very perceptive watch. Actually, this is something I'll talk about when I talk about TV. The word watch means to be alert and awake so as to protect one from. You know, like you put a watch on a fort to protect yourself. But this is not the way that most Americans think of watching TV. In fact, Americans, when polled, will say, 1 out of 5 Americans will say that they can watch TV and sleep at the same time. But really, what I encourage people to do is to watch in that root sense of the word. And I think that McKibben does that really brilliantly. And here he talks about all the things, just the different patterns of things that go on TV. Let me see if I can find it. Pardon me?
The humorous book, would you say?
It gets humorous at times, but the underlying it is this sort of tragic thing that's going on here. Both of them are very readable. My approach to college teaching is give students something that they like to read and want to talk about, and both of these books fit that category very well. I also don't wear a watch, so it may be that we're done, and I don't know. I'm happy to talk for as long as people want to, but some people may need to leave.
I guess going back to the fact that beyond not buying a McDonald's hamburger yourself or not even moving yourself, whatever you choose to do personally, to organize or to get other people that are not like-minded off the dime of, you know, what I find distressing is the thought that how do you move people in this direction who can't even part with money that they really don't need to educate students, you know, as far as, you know, you see the educational level of, you know, nationwide going down because people don't want to pay that money for education or for living in community in general. How do you motivate people?
But I think, for me, I try to get them in situations where you can ask them questions that make them think. Like, essentially, if you ask people, like this question, what is the purpose of your job? You know, for a lot of us, the job is a kind of routine of one sort or another, and we may or may not know exactly where it's connected up in the world, and it may not be connected up very well or very healthily. And when people think about that, sometimes they think about alternatives and possibilities that they might have. For me, and another thing, there's an article that I'll hand out. It will be the handout when I talk about the 60s. It's a thing by Robert McAfee Brown that he published in 1973 called The Lessons of the 60s. And one of the things in it says, which was a great solace to me, you are not called to be someone else. You are called to be who you are, where you are. And so you simply try to make the changes where you are and how you can, and not worry about the other stuff. I mean, I think what he was saying essentially is that faith tells you that God is working also. This is something that Thomas Merton said to a young radical in the 1960s. This guy wrote and said, Merton, we've been protesting this war forever, and it's not stopping. It's getting worse. And Merton wrote back and said, it's your job to be faithful to your calling. It's God's job to take care of everything else. And it's the job of the other faithful to join you when you've given your witness of what's going on. So I think we simply give the witness where we are and hope in a Christian sense that something comes of it. Right now, one of the things that I'm playing around with is that college teachers get to talk to college students and you have some influence on them, although many of them can be like Cody Nolene's class, interested in sex and passing grade. St. Olaf has a radio station, and so I've now created this character called Dr. Culture, who does these little short things on the invisible complexity of, so far I've done air conditioning and a lawn and what else have I done? I'm just doing a whole series of these, a weekly series of Dr. Culture kinds of things that are little educational bits that try to sort of just provoke people a little bit to think about, do I really need this one? And a lot of what I do in that is talk about primitive peoples. The one on air conditioning, for example. I talk about primitive peoples before air conditioning, what primitive peoples used to do. You know, they used to open windows, and they used to they used to stay out of the heat in the middle of the day. And they used to sit on large front porches, which were also a social invitation to people, instead of having decks on the back of the house. I'll probably do one on a deck sometime, because a deck is really an antisocial kind of thing for the most part. It's a sign of American privatism. So I'm just sort of picking all of these things and trying to show how they're connected up to one another. And hopefully, every once in a while somebody writes a letter saying, oh, you're so right about that. And I haven't had too many that said, you know, what an idiot you are.
Could you just say what your next seminar is and the time and topic?
The next one is Wednesday. I'm not sure what time. Chris, do you have any clue?
I don't have the schedule with me. It's on the kiosk.
I'm guessing Tuesday at 3:40 or Wednesday at 3:45. What I'm going to do is sort of work my way through a day over the next 2 weeks. And so on Wednesday we'll be waking up. And so the question is, what does it mean to wake up to an alarm clock? What does it mean to have to deal with the kind of time that we do? And then on Thursday, it's 4th of July, so I'm doing a 4th of July special. It's not on the moral ecology of contemporary life, but on the moral ecology of 18th century life and the ways in which there are things in the revolutionary period that we ought to be paying attention to. And then on Friday, we're going to have a cup of coffee so that we can really wake up. And on Saturday, we're going to get in the car to go to work. So we'll be driving a car on Saturday. And then next week, we're going shopping and going to work. Since I'm a teacher, we're going to school. Those are the things. I can't remember all of them right now, but that's sort of the structure of things. What does it mean to go to school? And then within that sort of particular things, why do those bells ring? What do bells mean? Why is it that classes can only be 55 minutes? You get a great conversation going, and actually, at 52 minutes, students are always folding up their notebooks and things like that at 52 minutes. And so it's just over. I mean, the structure of school guarantees that you can't have an ongoing conversation, or it makes it very hard to do that. Sometimes students will come around to the office and do that, but the bells make it very hard to do that. They make it very efficient for getting together with groups of students and moving them around campus, but they don't really contribute to the best education we might have. Grades are also counterproductive in that way. Actually, Dr. Coulter did a thing on grades right at the end of the school year, in which he gave grades a D.